The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Hello and welcome to Spirited Conversations, a locally produced live recording of a keynote speaker. I'm Jan Marsh for Fresh FM and the Spirited Conversations Committee. Recently, Stephen Gray led a spirited conversation on Is Democracy in Trouble? Reflections of a Democracy Promoter. Here is Sandy Stevens to introduce the evening.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Spirited Conversations. Now, Stephen's talk, he's a chap who I've worked with in a number of countries. I've known him for over 20 years. He came to Nelson from Minneapolis 27 years ago, and he's worked in development projects all over the world. He came to New Zealand with a bachelor's degree in criminal justice and a master's degree in international relations, economics and community development. His approach to working with people has been very much to do with engagement. And when he got into the political training field, his efforts to engage people in the political process were something I think New Zealanders could learn from, but we haven't. Stephen's also a very strategic thinker. And when I was working with him, he brought me into line several times. But we got along very well. Tonight, he'll lead the discussion about his work in low-income countries, used to be called developing countries. But he's going to use three case studies, three countries where he finds the democratic process interesting: Ghana, Indonesia, and Moldova. So on the basis of his experience in those three countries, we'll learn what New Zealand could learn from those countries. And he also makes some comparisons between the various countries he worked with and New Zealand's democratic process. So, Stephen, democracy, you have the mic.
I want to thank Spirited Conversations for inviting me to reflect on my career of providing development assistance in countries around the globe, and specifically my work on democracy assistance projects in over a dozen countries. I'm going to talk about my motivations and life goals and then share a few examples of the projects I was involved with. Relate all this to our recent experience with election 2023 and hopefully draw some lessons learned. My life goal, set in my teens, was to be a change agent for good. My definition of good was informed by my Reformed Jewish upbringing, which emphasized tikkun olam, which is translated as a need to repair the world. In our tradition, to be a good Jew meant working on that mission. It took me a few years to realize that for me, significant progress could best be achieved on this goal by empowering individuals and communities through evaluation, training, and education. I began my journey as a change agent as a child of the 60s, and near the end of that decade and into the 70s was involved in Vietnam War protests, serious discussions about what it meant to be a conscientious objector, and a participant in trying to develop alternative democracy-driven community institutions such as cooperatives, community health clinics, credit unions, and community development corporations. From 1976 to 78, I was fortunate to initiate and survive a trans-Pacific voyage on small yachts that began in Mexico and ended in New Zealand with extended stays in the Marquesas, Tuamotos, Tahiti, the Cooks, Samoa, Tokelau, and Fiji. I enjoyed it so much that I set out again in September 80 from Hawaii, this time to go around the globe, and made it as far as Tonga. Before my wife-to-be and I ended up becoming pregnant and realizing that it was time to go home and have our baby. Upon my return from the Pacific, I began a career as a program evaluation specialist, working on community development, public health, education, and justice projects with community nonprofit organizations and local governments. In the U.S., the international travel and then a subsequent degree in a master's in public policy, specializing in international and community development, saw me focus on international foreign aid projects instead of the domestic work I was doing in the U.S. I transitioned from working in low-income neighborhoods in the U.S. to helping low-income country governments and communities gain capacity to become continuous learning organizations. In other words, I saw my mission was to help organizations gain the capacity to gather data, reflect on how to improve their work of improving their communities, and then to plan and implement those improvements. I was fortunate to become a specialist in this realm in helping improve the administration of elections. I started down that path by working with the International Foundation for Election Systems, or IFES, a US-based charity dedicated to improving election and civic education institutions around the globe. My first assignment with IFES was in 1995 in Ghana. Flight Lieutenant Jerry Rawlings had led a military coup in 1992. And by 95, he felt the country was ready to transition to democracy. This included new democratic elections. IFES had credibility in Africa because it had assisted the South African Election Commission the year before in conducting the first post-apartheid election in South Africa. And like the South Africa experience, the credibility of any election in Ghana was going to be a complete and transparent voters list. Not necessarily an easy task in a low-income country with poor roads and challenging terrain. IFES's task was to help the Ghana Election Commission pull off the elections, including developing and implementing a training program for thousands of short-term voter registration workers, to say nothing of upgrading their internal governance systems, getting new computerized systems, and a whole range of other changes, including developing a public relations campaign about the voter registration exercise. You and I are used to getting a reminder in the mail or via email about our voter registration or to check our voter registration. But in 1995 in Ghana, mail was sporadic and computers were hardly present. In fact, one of my first tasks in my job was to train my counterparts in basic word processing, spreadsheet, and publication software. So people, especially in the rural areas, were living very basic lives. And even our voter registration centers were often outdoors or in makeshift structures. Imagine the challenge of training community leaders. Okay, they're literate, teachers, civil servants, those kinds of people. But in a relatively simple task, but one they've never done. And the task was to gather and input data, voter data, into a system that was new and had to be transparent and open to anyone's scrutiny. And that it also had to be accurate on election day. We had to upskill 60,000 voter registration workers along with 80,000 party agents who were going to scrutinize what the workers were doing for these workers to be the face of the election commission in villages and towns across the country. The preferred solution was short-term or two-day training sessions with workers. Now, if you do the math, this required 5,000 small group training sessions. And we're on a timeline. You know, we're doing it in a couple of months. So, I'd forgotten these numbers. I had to go back and check them. This is 20 years ago. So, if it was 5,000 events, to do that, we had to train 1,200 trainers. And to train the trainers, we needed to train 40 master trainers to train the trainers. So it was a 2-week training program for the master trainers, a week-long training program for the trainers, and then those trainers had to go out and do it in a few weeks, 2-day training sessions around the country. And this is with a commission that had never done that before. So it was an interesting challenge. My objective was to create a training department that could design, develop, and implement training programs on their own into the future while designing 3 simultaneous training programs at the same time for this voter registration exercise. And I was saying it earlier at the dinner table, but one of the greatest things, of course, and I'll mention it later as well, is when you see the faces of people who, one, are encouraged to take control and to have power, but then when they really get confident that you're actually relying on them to do that job. And often, most often, I've observed that people rise to that task. Anyway, over the next 22 years, democracy assistance projects would comprise about 40% of the work that I did. The beauty of my work on elections was that it empowered citizens to have a say in their governance. That first 5-month assignment in Ghana, which had a widely successful transition to democracy, and in the end, the Ghanaian Election Commission became an effective agent for change itself in the region. But that led to other assignments in Bangladesh, Albania, Yemen, Macedonia, Indonesia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Moldova, Ukraine, Kosovo, and Zimbabwe. In 2003 and 2004, in Indonesia, I was an IFAS consultant with the General Election Commission of Indonesia. That was an amazing experience. The militarily dependent country was emerging from the Timor-Leste debacle, a deep financial hole because of the global financial crisis of 1997, and they were also engaging in a deliberate effort to reduce the military's influence. Prior to that time, the military had 38 representatives in the People's Assembly, in their parliament. And the other thing was the assembly used to elect the president. Well, this election, there was going to be a direct popular election for president. The number of potential voters was 140 million people out of a population of 230, spread out over 5 time zones and on over 6,000 islands. Voting stations had an average of 400 voters, which meant that there were over 500,000 polling stations in the country. Each polling station was governed by a committee of 5 people that oversaw activities on election day. The logistics are staggering to think about. Imagine getting paper election supplies to all those places for a 1-day election event across all those islands and isolated mountain villages. My task was to assist the commission in designing training programs and materials for the 2.5 million people who needed to be trained in election day procedures. These were the committee members of the polling stations. As it turned out, in 2004, Indonesia conducted 3 nationwide elections in 4 months. The first one was for parliamentary elections. And there were so many candidates on the ballot that the ballot was the size of a newspaper extended out. So it was just a massive printing issue. And then the second and third events were for first round and runoff presidential elections. Interestingly, the military proved very useful as they were put to productive use delivering a lot of those election supplies across the country. Working in our favor was and is the high rate of literacy within the country. 97% of the population is able to read and write. So the issue of delivering a consistent training experience was eased somewhat. At least the written materials could be read. However, delivering small group training, the most effective form of doing this kind of skill building, was not going to happen. That just was not going to happen. We settled on an illustrated handbook with lots of pictures, but also text. And that was compared to, I forget about this detail, but often when I was coming into these countries, the standard was, if you were an election committee member, you know, either at the polling station or the province or the city, all you got was the election law. And it's a very dense legal document, you know. You didn't get any explanation, any materials, any illustrations showing you how to do things. So that was a big innovation that we were able to introduce at that time in Indonesia. The other thing we did was we supplemented it with, we created a dramatized training video with a lot of humor in it. And we ended up negotiating a deal with the national broadcaster to broadcast that several times in the weeks prior to the election. And so we could give the trainees a heads up, hey, you know, turn on the TV at this time, it's going to be on. But it became so popular because, one, it was humorous, but two, they didn't have a lot of local content that showed local activity. And here we were, you know, taking a typical village, and we had people on motorcycle, you know, little scooters and things coming in, and it was really well received. The TV station ended up running it way more times than we contracted with them to do it because it was just getting so much play and interest. Turnout for the parliamentary election was 84% that year, and 78% and 75% for the two subsequent presidential elections. So you're talking about 120 million people voting in these elections. The biggest event I've seen. I hear great things about India, which instead of doing it on one day, this is one day too, by the way. Ask me about that later. That's a very interesting example. But India and some other countries that have incredible logistics end up doing their elections on rolling through several days throughout the month or different weeks in different regions. Anyway, in 2010, we became empty nesters, and I accepted a full-time role as country director for IFAS in the Republic of Moldova. Does anybody know where the Republic of Moldova is? It's a small former Soviet Union republic sandwiched between the Ukraine and Romania, and was part of, well, it was part of Romania after World War I, and then became part of the Soviet Union after World War II. It became an independent parliamentary democracy after the fall of the Soviet Union, and like many former Soviet republics, was still economically within the sphere of Russia. And due to the way, the Russians were very clever, like the Han Chinese, you might say, in China, but they had a deliberate policy during the Soviet Union to move a lot of Russian speakers into these other republics. So by the time that the independence happened, it was about 50% Russian-speaking and 50% Romanian-speaking, which is the crux of part of its issues right now. Although the war in Ukraine has changed things there dramatically. But anyway, having this more management role and higher up role got me into a lot of policy discussions, but also got me on with the level of the leaders of the country, and the leaders of the election commission. And lucky for me, the key leaders of the Central Election Commission, or CEC, were open to new ideas and even had ideas of their own that meshed very nicely with the vision of the CEC becoming a learning organization, promoting and organizing free and fair elections. Of course, as with anything, the more you learn about it, the more complicated it becomes, and democracy is definitely one of those things. The most common marker of a democracy is a free and fair election. We all think about that. That sounds simple enough, but it can be really difficult for organizations that have traditionally been run from the top down and without any effective learning feedback loop in their governance. Defining and living up to the free and fair definition is especially challenging for old, sclerotic, centrally run Soviet organizations. But that's true no matter whether it's former British colonies or whatever. They all struggle with this idea of becoming dynamic and learning. But this is the way we've always done things. Yeah, but it doesn't work. Well, yeah, but we always do it that way. And, you know, that's very powerful. I came to understand that if an organization wasn't a dynamic learning organization, it was going to struggle to produce an election that could be considered free and fair and seen that way by the public. Now, we were able to improve our chances for success in Moldova by developing an electoral training institute within but separate from the commission. The Center for Continuing Education in the Electoral Field, as you would translate it directly from the Romanian, has developed into one of the premier democratic institutions in the country. And this is a little country, by the way, of 3.5 million people, struggling in the face of a huge behemoth called Russia, you know, controlling a lot of what goes on in their lives. That training center has grown and matured in a way I could have never really predicted. It develops its own training programs and has moved beyond election day training. So now they train public officials, including judges, election watchdogs, students, civic education organizations, and others critical to that democracy. Its influence has spread beyond Moldova to other countries, especially in the former USSR. And we could talk about Ukraine if you want. I have experience there as well. So democracy is complicated, and elections are only one element of a functioning democracy being accountable to its citizens. What else do you need? You need just laws, a free and fair press, the ability to organize political parties, trust in the process, in the organization that's responsible for elections. You need transparent campaign finance and informed participation by as many citizens as possible. Each one of those individual elements is difficult enough to develop. And probably the most critical is trust. Trust in government institutions that might have been captured by a ruling party in previous years or might even just be established just now. I'd like to think that most of the project I worked on were successful, although I had my share of experiences where it didn't quite work out. It's incredibly challenging to make significant changes in a politically traumatic situation. Case in point, in 2005, I worked in Afghanistan as a training consultant for the Joint Election Management Body. That country was still in a war zone in many areas, with competing militias, as well as the Taliban vying for control in parts of the country. Afghanistan's fairly low literacy rate, around 20% in 2005, provided an added challenge. However, in 2004, they adopted a new constitution. And so the 2005 parliamentary elections were the first that were going to include former warlords who, you know, had vied for control over different parts of the country. And it also had a mandate that 25% of the seats had to be for women. My job, that assignment, was to develop a training program on election management and election dispute mediation and resolution for the 34 provincial election commissions. The PECs had been recently formed to provide a provincially based citizen voice for election administration in the country. Now think about that. That in itself is a big step. You're talking about a country that was always centrally run, never really had elections, and now they were just, they had had some elections in the previous years. You know, the invasion happened, I think it was 2002 or 3. They had had a presidential election in 2003 that was quite successful. But they didn't have the institutions really developed. And in fact, the Joint Election Management Body, the group I was working for, had Afghans in it, but it was really controlled by the Western, the UN and other donors like the US who were involved in the assistance project. So the challenge, so we had 34 members in these 34 committees, three members each, including one woman had to be one of the members. So there was a total target training of about 136 people. The challenge was to develop a new democratic mechanism, albeit for a temporary election period, including the voices of women in a culture that didn't normally do that sort of thing. However, in 2005, there was still optimism that democracy had a chance and that the U.S. and its allies would be able to help develop democratic institutions. I personally oversaw the training. We got 128 out of the 136 to attend. We originally were going to do a two-week session in different locations around the country, but due to a variety of challenges, including security, it ended up being a five-day training in Kabul, but people were coming in. People came from all over the country, and what struck me again was how enthusiastically they took on to this training. They wanted to have these conversations. What does it mean to not do the election procedure correctly? Well, how should a complaint come in? What form should it be in? Should we be complaining? You know, all sorts of things about the logistics in their areas as well. You know, I say they were really enthusiastic about a new process that would allow people to exercise their agency to vote and also complain about it if it didn't go according to the legal and agreed upon process. That is an amazing thing. And we take it for granted that we can make those complaints, but we don't understand what it takes to set up an institution to be able to do that. You know, it's really interesting when you get into small group discussions and you see people really grappling with these issues for the first time about who can vote, how can they vote, where can they vote, how should it be, how should the process be set up. The resulting parliamentary election was mixed. It was a challenging security environment, and it was changing often. The resulting parliamentary election saw a turnout of only 50% compared to the 84% for the previous year's presidential election. But the Election Complaints Commission was pretty happy. They reported a much better process for processing and adjudicating election disputes. Sadly, as an indicator of the challenges of working in Afghanistan, a few months after the training, one of the PEC members from Kandahar, a Muslim cleric, was assassinated by the Taliban for cooperating with the democratic process. Another assignment that wasn't very productive was in Zimbabwe from 2016 to 2018. Because of the success we had achieved in Moldova, I was primed to see if we could replicate that kind of institution building elsewhere. I had hoped Zimbabwe was on the cusp of change and might be open to becoming a more open and honest democracy. Robert Mugabe and his ZANU-PF had ruled the country for 37 years in 2016. He was 93. I thought, what the heck, he's going to die soon, you know? And, that might really be the catalyst for change in a way that we couldn't predict. It would be late 2017 when he was deposed in a coup. And so the 2018 elections, interestingly, became a chance to see if the Zimbabwe Election Commission was ready to be independent, transparent, and trustworthy. From a financial point of view, IFAS was really thrilled with my work there. I was able to leverage additional funding. I added a couple of million to the budget and expand our presence. But I was increasingly unhappy because it became crystal clear pretty early on that even after the coup, that it was going to be business as usual and that the kind of institutional change I was aiming for wasn't going to take place. At the end of my career, I was looking for those kinds of experiences where you see people wholeheartedly realize that continuous learning and improvement are critical and that they're really exciting. The good news about the program in Zimbabwe is that we were able to provide significant resources to civil society organizations around the country. We set up small grants to build the capacity of civic education groups to inform citizens about the election process and issues. We worked on improving disability access to voting stations, trying to prevent election violence, improving campaign finance, transparency and regulation, and encouraging youth turnout. The not-so-good news was that the ZEC, the Zimbabwe Election Commission, didn't take most of our advice and only made superficial changes to their organization, despite loads of assistance being available, not only from us, but others, that are in that field. According to the number of registered voters, turnout was high, 85%. But the voter registration process missed about 21% of eligible voters, an indication among many others that the ZEC wasn't really serious about its responsibilities. So, five really different examples, I guess. But how does it apply to our situation here and our experience here in Aotearoa? We're a high-income country, so our challenges are different to the low-income and war-torn countries that I worked in. However, one key lesson in my life is that democracy is an ongoing enterprise. It takes serious work all the time. A country cannot take a break from civic education, ensuring that all votes are fairly counting, and trying to enfranchise those who have become disconnected from or are new to their right to vote. In general, here, we're in good shape. We have moderately high turnout, a relatively well-informed and literate citizenry, a professional election administration who improves their performance almost every year, and a parliamentary system that wastes relatively few votes. Fortunately, in the late 90s, we switched from first-past-the-post parliamentary system to MMP, and that system provides more diverse voices in the parliament, encourages coalition governments, and wastes few votes. However, it does need to be fine-tuned. It's too bad that tonight we still have 20% of the vote outstanding and the result that need to be accounted for. However, we know a few things. It looks like overall turnout for this past election will be down. by about a couple hundred thousand people. Now, that doesn't sound like much, and it maybe isn't, but when you consider how many tight electric races we had, how many races that were settled by under 1,000 votes, every vote really makes a difference. As in past elections, while turnout in the provincial electorates was over 80%, 86 here in Nelson, turnout in Maori and urban electorates was less than 70%. I noticed that the Maori electorates in particular this past election had lower voter turnout than in 2020 and 2017. And my guess is that when all the results are in, we'll see decreased turnout among those voters under 24 years old. So a few percent here and there can really make a difference. And we obviously need to reach out to younger voters to encourage them to vote, especially when you consider how close some of these electoral seats were. And my understanding with the preliminary results and taking into account how special votes have gone in the past, that we'll see those electorates that the Green Party won or that ACT won, that they had lower turnout in the end. And so Labor just didn't get as many votes as it got in previous elections. And a lot of Labor voters defected to Green or Maori, and a lot of national voters went to ACT. And I don't know who the New Zealand versus voters are, but yeah. It's a good reminder that voting matters. Poland recently turned back a very authoritarian government with approximately 73% voter turnout. That was very good for them. Meanwhile, over in Louisiana, in the U.S., they just elected a really far right-wing governor and with a turnout of about 35%, which means, if you think about it, that governor was elected with 18% of the population, of the voting population, voting for him. I also believe that our 5% MMP threshold is too high. In 2020, we had a large number of wasted votes. If it had been 4%, that number of wasted votes would have been halved. You know, I don't know if you remember, but New Zealand First, I think, had 4.6% or 4.7%. So you don't want to have more than a few percent of people whose vote didn't count for anything. That's just good democracy. You want people to feel as included in the government as possible. So 8%, which was about what was in 2020, was a little too high. On the other hand, you don't want it too low. I always say, and we could talk about Israel-Palestine if you want, but the biggest problem Israel had initially was that its threshold for parliamentary representation was 2.25%. And this let in all sorts of kooks and crazies and religious nuts who then drove policy in a way that wasn't conducive to consensus and building a nation. I'm sympathetic to those who advocate for compulsory voting, but I don't agree with it. In New Zealand, we still have hundreds of thousands of voters who aren't registered to vote. It's about 7,000 or 8,000 in Nelson alone of people who are eligible to vote but haven't gotten on the list. So while turnout in 2020 was 86% in Nelson, it was 80% of potential voters. That's still pretty high, but you can see how when you get to turnout of 60% in some Maori wards or in some urban areas, then you're looking at a potential of, you know, maybe 55% of the people involved. Requiring people to vote doesn't, if you look at Australia or Brazil, it doesn't necessarily turn out any better. Their democracy, their governance doesn't necessarily create better decisions. And So the jury's out for me on whether compulsory voting is the key reform. Really, it's about making it easier for people to vote. Now, we've done that. Mail, early voting, it's pretty easy. We lose something in it. We can talk about that in the question and answer session. But those innovations do more to increase turnout than compulsory voting. Okay, so I hope this brief introduction to my work on democracy projects has helped you consider the complexity of this democracy enterprise that I think we all take for granted. I know I was continually inspired by how important the act of voting is for someone who has never done it before, or was trapped in a political system that didn't accurately count votes, or didn't value votes, or accountability back to the populace. We're lucky, but we also need to continue improving how we encourage informed people about voting. Maybe the most critical element of all is a well-informed citizenry. I think initiatives like Vote Compass were great in helping people see what parties had policies that reflected their view. We need more of that. I'm also a great supporter of lowering the voting age. I believe that 16-year-olds should have the right to vote, and secondary schools should have civic education classes that help young people research and discover what political discourse is all about. It's crucial to start young, to encourage engagement in elections, and to assist our younger citizens to think carefully and critically about what it means to be a citizen. I actually began my career in democracy, if you could call it that, when I was 7 years old. My mom was the local president of the League of Women Voters in Minnesota. And that meant on election night, the League conducted a parallel vote count of all the precincts in the state, all the voting stations in the state. So they would take over the call center of a local department store, and there were like 40 phones, and there were volunteers on the phones, and people were ringing from all over the state. You know, watchers were ringing in with the results, and we were putting the results up. And my job as a 7-year-old, was when a telephone operator held up their hand, I had to rush to get that piece of paper and run it up to the big chalkboard in the front of the room that was being updated with the results. I retired 5 years ago. The Zimbabwe assignment was my last gig. I was lucky to miss the challenge of working internationally in the time of COVID-19. And since then, I'm focused more locally on community environment issues with the Friends of the Mai Tai and BirdLife Center of New Zealand. So I'm totally immersed in issues of pest control and river health, if you want to talk about that. So this has been kind of interesting to go back after 5 years and reflect on this career that used to occupy my life. It was an opportunity to go back and read old reports and remember how challenging each situation was. So as we go into the break, I want you to reflect on the parts of the democratic process that you think we need to improve here in New Zealand. What about those people not on the voters list? What about our civic education for new and young citizens? Should we consider other changes to our system? I can share other stories for days on other emerging democracies and other countries I worked in. I think it's about 40 countries in all. So thanks for your attention, and I look forward to the Q&A after the break.
That was Stephen Gray, recorded live at a spirited conversation at Yaza Cafe in Nelson during October. Spirited Conversations air Friday afternoon at 3. Podcasts of this and previous episodes can also be found at freshfm.net and the accessmedia.nz app. Just look for Spirited Conversations. I'm Jan Marsh. Thanks for joining us for Spirited Conversations at Fresh FM.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community Access Media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.